We're very welcome to have Dr. Raymond Peet joining us on the show this evening. And Dr. Peet, you're there?
Yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us again. I think, firstly, what I wanted to just discuss, I know we did go over vaccination. I think it was back in June of 2014, and ran through the introduction of vaccines and mentioned that disease was in free fall decline before the introduction of vaccines through good food, increased sanitation and clean water, etc., especially in industrialized countries. So going on to what has been described as another bill to wipe out yet more choice, California's Bill 277 seeks to impose mandatory vaccination and no either religious or ethical exemptions. So people are not going to be able to say, it's my belief that I believe there's a better future for my child if I don't vaccinate them, or I have a religious preference against vaccination. But let me just first, I kind of forgot, I get a bit too excited about this month. This bill only came out yesterday, so it's kind of last minute top of the hour thing for us. I know we're going to get into the degraded food in the food chain and bring out the whole, well, we'll talk about it a bit later on, but anyway, but it all amounts to a very decreased health perspective for most people in terms of what it is they eat, if they only knew what was in it. But would you just please first start by letting people know your scientific and academic background for those people who perhaps have never heard of you?
My PhD is from the University of Oregon in biology in 1972. I've taught in few different institutions, State University of Mexico, Veracruz University, and two or three schools in the United States, but a variety of science courses, including immunology at the University of Veracruz. So I'm, even though I didn't specialize or study it, I learned somewhat what's going on in the immune system, and that teaching had got me interested in following the development.
Okay. All right. So a good introduction for people who've never heard of you. Okay. So talking about the Senate Bill 277 now, so abolishing most opt-outs, I think the only exemption is going to be permitted medical exemptions for either immunocompromised children, maybe receiving chemotherapy for leukemia and that kind of thing, or immunosuppression drugs, and or those people who are currently using antiretrovirals for HIV, etc. But there'll be no choice to opt out for people that don't believe that the science is pointing in the right direction. Last June, we talked about the studies that were done initially by World Health Organization with those three populations, of which, Sarah, do you want to talk about that? Because it's something that you've been more familiar with.
Well, Dr. Pete's very familiar with that.
Okay. Well, okay. So Dr. Peet, why don't you bring that out again? Go ahead.
The World Health Organization around 1970 that, they did it. I read it a little after that. They took three villages, I think, in Guatemala, and left one as a control population. The other one they sent the regular public health team with vaccination and getting, I think it was chlorinated water for the drinking supply, just the usual minimal public health things. And okay. Then the other one, they provided a nutritional supplement to all of the pregnant women in the village, and during their breastfeeding time, and to the children. And relative to the control village that didn't have any doctors or help sent in, the medically treated village, the health got worse by several measurements, and the health in the village that simply got the nutritional supplement was generally better, as well as the kids being bigger and healthier and more intelligent.
Okay. So the World Health Organization then came up with the conclusion that actually the far cheaper and easier thing to do was to use vaccination as a standard of care.
That isn't a popular thing with the world pharmaceutical industry, because they want to sell drugs rather than food.
Yeah, exactly. I'm saying much the same thing, is that the introduction of vaccinations is a very easy way to deploy, material to third world and other developing countries as a supposed way of increasing people's health. But okay, so getting on to this Senate Bill 277, and they're basically saying that California is going to be one of only three states that have mandatory forced vaccination with no opt-outs, the only other two being Mississippi and West Virginia. I think for anybody listening who really does take this to heart and wants to find out more information, I'd really like you to jot down this web address, which will outline the senators involved, where they get their funding from, namely Merck, and what there is to lose behind allowing this bill to become law. I mean, that's the quintessential part of American life, isn't it? It's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and freedom of choice, isn't it? So the website is www.s-277.us, and that article will outline everything that you might want to know about the epidemic of vaccine legislation funded by Merck that's happening currently. So in terms of the vaccines, they say that going to be 34 to 36 vaccines mandated by the age of 6 years old. And then obviously there's another batch of vaccines from the age of 6 through 18, and then still further vaccines mandated from 18 on. And I think this does apply to schooling and other institutions for education.
I think all in all, it's a total of 69 vaccines that are scheduled, are on the schedule for a baby child and teenager to receive.
So, Dr. Pete, do you have anything that you think about specifically with regards to vaccination and what's been shown in the scientific research to support the argument for healthy standards of living and nutrition and clean water, etc., sanitation, as being far more important than vaccination?
The history of looking at the relation of vaccination to disease, specific disease incidence and mortality, goes back more than 100 years. And Ivan Illich was one of the first people to do a survey of the research that had been gathered over the years. I think Suzanne Humphrey's website is a good introduction to that perspective, and she also has some information on the actual effect of the vaccine material on the baby's immune system and the need for taking a completely new look at what the immune system is, how it relates to the development of the person, rather than to fighting disease. This is a relatively new approach to looking at immunity called the danger theory, in which the body is really reacting to disruption of its tissues, and the immune system is there to repair and compensate for the injury. And it just, from this point of view, it just happens that the infectious agent gets in the way of that repair process, and it's incidental really to what the immune system is doing.
So they could just be injecting mercury and aluminum and other immune system irritants and get the same effect?
To a great extent. But one of the interesting things is that Suzanne Humphreys mentions is that in one study in which they used an actual placebo control rather than a different vaccine. So they saw the difference between injecting just water or the vaccine. They didn't see any difference in the specific infection rate to the disease that the vaccine was aimed at, but they saw 6 or 7 times greater incidence of other infections in the vaccinated kids.
Well, this is, there's a lot of organizations like that are now saying that vaccinated children are less healthy than unvaccinated children. And it's very hard to do a study like this because there's so many children that are vaccinated and not very many children that are unvaccinated.
Yeah, and there's not likely to be any funding to do that kind of study.
Okay, and the whole from a perspective of good health, or from a perspective of practicing medicine, and the Hippocratic Oath, that statement "first do no harm," I think, continually sounds in my ear, and the definite and litigated damages claims that are being pursued in the courts against damaged children from drug companies, it is rather obvious for anybody who wants to take a look at it. There's plenty of groups that have emerged as parents of damaged children, etc., campaigning for better access to litigation, because in fact all of the companies that produce vaccines, folks, are indemnified by the government against any and all damage arising out of the use of vaccines. So how does that sound to you? First do no harm, but you can produce a product, and as and when it damages somebody, you cannot be held liable for it. That sounds very, it sounds like a very serious contravention of the American Constitution in terms of the population and its right and access to, everything that is good, and to be protected from those things that are not good and or fast becoming massive control of both the food and the drug industry in this country and in most economized world populations. So yeah, first do no harm. It's obvious that vaccines have caused harm. The companies are indemnified against all and every claim. So they unfortunately don't have too many places to go to get any kind of recourse for what's happened. Okay, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM from the 7:30, or that period of time onwards to 8 o'clock at the close of the show. You're invited and call to call in with any questions related to this month's subject of the recent Senate Bill 277 passing legislation for mandatory vaccination. And then also we're going to get into the whole aspect of food and the degradation of food and the food chain, and specifically starches, and how these degraded foods wind up in our in most people's foods, and how labeling laws do not reflect the dangers of the ingredients, and how these ingredients can in turn bring poor health without doubt, and obesity, etc., etc., and how this all works against people. So, but
the poor food in our food chain is supporting the vaccine companies, because people are not well enough to resist disease. So, Dr. Pete, do you think that unvaccinated children are at risk of socializing with vaccinated children?
There are cases in which a vaccinated child has spread the vaccine organism, where they used a live polio virus, and the vaccinated kid has infected unvaccinated people. But the senators proposing or getting that bill passed, we're claiming that the unvaccinated children are putting everyone at risk, he said. But if most of the kids are vaccinated, aren't they protected?
What are they going to catch?
The reasoning just seems absolutely crazy. You can't put them at risk if they're protected. So apparently the senator didn't believe that the vaccines are protecting anyone. How would they be at risk?
Well, and then also there's vaccine failure. We were taught by the microbiologists who work for the British government that no vaccine was successful apart from the smallpox. So really there's failure on all the vaccines. And if good food, good nutrition, supplementation, clean water, clean air, if that's more effective than vaccines, then, you know, why would someone go any further?
Okay, I just wanted to remind people again, if you're, hopefully you're interested, the website, which you can find out a lot more information about the senators who are primarily behind this Bill 277 and where they get their funding from, is plain to see, and it's certainly disclosed by Merck, where they fund people's campaigns and the senators who are funded by Merck. And without saying any names, folks, just go take a look at the website, www.sb-277-.us, rather, and you'll find all the information there. And it's pretty straightforward, pretty obvious, and pretty shocking. But hey, unfortunately, a lot of people have their interests elsewhere. But that's, I think, in this area.
And there's
certainly
lots,
people are a lot more conscious.
There's lots more information online. You can visit the National Vaccine Information Center, which is www.nvic for National Vaccine Information Center.org. So nvic.org. And also there's doctors that are behind the real science of the dangers of vaccine, which one of them is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and her website is www.drtenpenny.com. 10 as in the number 10. And there's also a movie called The Greater Good, and that's www.greatergoodmovie.org. So there's more information for people who want to read some more.
Okay, well, Dr. Pete, let's make the link between degraded food and ill health, declining health, et cetera, and how a lot of this can tie in with the option to just make it simple and vaccinate everybody, because out of that first study that we first talked about, that was the conclusion that was drawn. So inexpensive, low quality food then, the appearance is pretty deceptive when you see it. These real shiny apples that just look too good to be true, with wax coatings and genetically engineered, of course, to not spoil on the shelf for a long time. And people out here listen to this. Do you read label ingredients of your food? Or don't you really mind? Don't you care? I know in England, before I came here in 2001, probably for 15 years at least, there was fully disclosed supplement fact labels on every package, everything that you would buy in a supermarket. You could see exactly what ingredients were in it. They would say if they had artificial colors or flavors or this, that, or the other. And when I first came here, I really didn't see any labels, and I didn't ever come across people looking at packaged food and or food on the shelf and taking a look at the label to see if there was information that they might be concerned about. But it's estimated that starch provides about 70 to 80% of the calories consumed by humans worldwide. So we can get into the description of starch here in a moment, Dr. Pete. But why is it? I mean, I know it's cheap and it's easy to mass cultivate, and now it's patentable in the form of GMO corn and potato and rice especially. So how do we make that connection?
I think the cheapness is the main factor for even dietitians are taught to promote a certain amount of starch in the diet. And starting in the 1930s, the U.S. government designed and taught dietitians to promote three levels of nutrition. One to simply prevent starvation, emphasizing beans and cereals. Another middle class, more health-oriented diet, and then the rich person's diet with plenty of animal protein. And that emphasis, originally it was relatively meaningful, valuable to hungry people to know how to get by on a diet of just a few cents a day for beans and grains, balancing things for minimal survival purposes. Mm-hmm. But for economic reasons, the breakfast cereal industry subsidized nutrition journals and dietetics journals and taught dietitians to say that these things are healthful, the foods that were originally promoted just to survive, now they're called health foods, whole cereals, legumes, and so on.
So it's gone full circle.
Yeah, so the rich people now are indoctrinated so that they're eating whole grain bread and so on.
Okay. All right. Well, let's getting on to starch. I something that really caught my attention when you first talked about it back in, oh gosh, you know what? It was the middle of last year sometime, but you mentioned some pioneering work done by
Gerhard
Volkheimer, right, and starches. Would you describe that?
He was, he rediscovered work that had been done 70 or 80 years earlier, and it's called persorption of particles, and it refers to the fact that even though ordinary digestion theory says that even proteins are broken down in the intestine and absorbed as small molecule particles, amino acids, he and his predecessors showed that if you feed starch consisting of the naturally formed starch grains, which can range from half the diameter of a red blood cell to about 10 times the diameter of a red blood cell. In other words, much, much too big to even pass through the smallest arterioles. Definitely, a lot of them will plug up capillaries, and many of them block arterioles. He demonstrated both with people and with mice that feeding starch, like a cup of a slurry of cornstarch, for example, and then drawing blood about 15 minutes later, he could find the type of starch particle that they had drunk in the bloodstream. And then 15 minutes later, he would start finding it in other body compartments. It would show up in the urine passing through the kidney barrier, and ultimately he found it in the cerebrospinal fluid. Every compartment of the body, he could find these starch grains plugging arteries with experimental animals. He would slice them up at different stages, having been fed starch chronically. And he found that it caused mice to age prematurely. And when he sliced them up, he found that every place that one of these starch grains lodged in an arteriole or capillary, the surrounding cells would be starved of nutrients and would die. So that these animals, it was like being having a shotgun working internally, killing little pockets of cells. And he was an immunologist. That was what got him interested in it, thinking about how your food can affect the immune system. If it's broken down into small particles before it gets into the body, the immune system simply isn't going to see anything allergenic. But if these big particles get into the bloodstream, they're going to come in contact with all the parts of the immune system. And so the simple fact that big particles are in the body means that our immune system is constantly being exposed to antigens. And he demonstrated that the circulatory damage was very clear. But as an immunologist, he believed that those particles were contributing to diseases that corresponded to the type of antigen in the food.
So the foods we should avoid that contain high starch granules or high starch percent would be grains and...
Any starchy food. And if the starch is very, very well cooked, like boiling it for 40 to 60 minutes, and then eating it with fat, the fat slows down the absorption and allows the digestive enzymes to soften it up so that it doesn't get through the barrier of the intestine without being further broken down.
Presumably, most people's intestines, for want of a better word, would be inflamed from poor diets, from poor food, dietary insults, that we'll call them. And in that case, then they are probably more at risk and more subject to that passage of starch granules through the intestinal barrier, what would normally be a barrier or perceived to be a barrier. But
And that inflammation, besides weakening the barrier function, that is increased by the immune reactions increase the production of inflammatory materials, and it becomes a vicious circle. And two nutrients that are very important in stopping that vicious circle are magnesium and vitamin A. And both of those are dependent on having adequate protein in the diet.
Okay, so fats taken with starches, and I think you have mentioned this before, it does ring a bell with me anyway. You said that fats, when mixed with starches, slow the absorption and or passage, if you like, of these starch granules through into the bloodstream. And that's why you advocate plenty of butter with potatoes, for example.
Having the digestive enzymes being produced abundantly, that requires a total good nutrition, good thyroid function, and so on.
Yeah, because if you have low thyroid function, then don't you have low hydrochloric acid, and it's hard for you to start breaking down the food?
All of the little glands in the digestive system slow down, don't produce as many enzymes.
And your liver won't produce the same amount of bile and... Well, and also, you know, soaking of grains and, you know, in Mexico, they are, you know, for thousands of years, corn has been.
Yeah, even in my parents' and grandparents' generation, the way bread was made was completely different. And letting it rise for 8 or 10 hours, wetting the dough, adding sugar, letting the yeast grow. The slow leavening process of using wheat or other grains activated enzymes that broke down the starches, turned them to sugar, let the yeast grow, and activated enzymes that broke down the gluten. And the combination of the carbohydrate, the sugar as energy, and the amino acids liberated from breaking down the gluten produce new proteins, so that the slow leavening actually can increase the protein by 100 or 200%.
And the same with the corn, because it increases the absorption of the nutrients when corn is mixed with boiled with lime.
It decreases toxins and increases the nutrients.
So it's modern day food that's killing us.
The grain slowly. People thousands of years ago discovered that the both the slow leavening and boiling the grains with lye or lime would break down the toxins and make them more nutritious. So it's just the since about 1940, when the bread industry discovered that they could make instant bread by adding chemicals to blow it up.
All right, so Dr. Pete, some of the ingredients that are not listed. I know we are probably going to be looking quite a bit at the starches, because there's something that you've talked about quite a bit, and I know that you're not particularly an advocate of starch, although you do recommend things like tortillas as a good alternative when they've been made with lye to make them far more digestible. You're not totally opposed to sourdough bread either, are you?
No, it's very safe compared to the standard bread.
Yeah. Okay, so not only have we talked about GMO and one of the three main GMO products that are certainly flooding the food chain here, obviously potatoes, corn, and then I know there's some rice to some extent is becoming GMO, and then potatoes. I heard some potatoes also now being grown fairly widely as a genetically modified product.
Well, when I was visiting a food safety scientist at the USDA labs in Berkeley, he told me that we went into the little lab kitchen to pick something up out of the freezer, and they told me that they were working on adding a new fiber to breads, and Dow Chemical was paying the USDA to test the food safety of adding this wood pulp sawdust to the bread. It was not a grain fiber. It was from wood. It was wood pulp. And they were making bread with wood pulp, and they were going to advertise it as increased fiber. Bread that has increased fiber.
Okay, I think the Germans discovered that method during a famine. They extended, at least they gave it to their war prisoners. And when they almost entirely omitted the cereal and made the bread of sawdust, the purpose was to kill off the war prisoners faster.
Okay, we have a caller on the air, so let's take this first caller. Caller, you're on the air, where are you from?
Little meningitis. When some antibiotic that she tried didn't work on an ear infection at 4 years old, and possibly they never gave that immunization out as a regular basis. At least I wasn't even aware of it until my child contracted spinal meningitis, and I believe that is a dangerous disease.
Yeah, well, thank God for antibiotics when your child gets spinal meningitis.
Yes, but also not thank God for the parents that I've known who've had children vaccinated for pertussis and ended up permanently paralyzed. You might want to read the book, The Poisoned Needle, and investigate a little bit deeper into the subject.
Well,
also, one of the polio vaccines that I have heard about, there were two forms of them, and one of them can be quite dangerous, as well as the pertussis. Now, I am a believer in tetanus vaccination, especially here in the hills, and that isn't actually caused by rust. It's caused by horse manure.
We were trying not to get into too much specifics because we don't have time on this show, so thank you for your call.
Okay, I think we have another caller on the air. Where are you from, caller?
Missouri.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Oh, pretty good, carry on.
So, you know, I guess one thing I wanted to find out is on starches, Dr. Pete, is there any differences from, say, like the starch in white rice and the starch in potato and any other starches that come to mind? And then the other thing I was wondering, I know you've commented several times that potatoes have a really high quality protein. I think I've even heard you say that it's actually maybe even better than eggs. And I'm wondering, eating something like potatoes that are well cooked with butter or coconut oil, or even some kind of meat, you know, like a ruminant, versus eating white rice or even whole rice or whole wheat bread, does the body, because it's gearing up to digest protein, possibly secrete more enzymes that would be effective in breaking down those starch molecules in the potato? I guess I'm trying to defend the potato in my own mind to a certain degree, because I've really enjoyed cooking them many ways, such as, you know, hash browns cooked in coconut oil and then putting it under the broiler and kind of browning them, and then putting eggs on top and putting it back in the broiler. And I just love these different foods with potatoes. I also grow potatoes. I realize that the philosophy or the, you know, a lot of people will say, well, people have been eating potatoes for thousands of years, or they'll say they've been eating bread for thousands of years. I realize it may be all they had and that's why they're eating it, but.
So you're asking, are you asking if eating protein with the potato is going to increase the enzymes to digest the starch in the potato?
Yeah, just to make it a little less precarious. Kind of gearing everything up rather than just eating something like white rice, which doesn't have protein in it.
Norman Curie wrote a good book many years ago on the quality of plant proteins, and he rated rice, I think, as a 6% value, where an egg yolk was 100% value, and leaf protein, if it's extracted from the fiber and the fats, leaf protein is about 70% value on his scale, where the protein in potato, I think, was about 105%, slightly better than egg yolk in quality. So it's roughly 15 or 20 times better than rice or bean protein by Curie's scale. And starch grain in potato is one of the biggest. It's about 100 microns in diameter. Rice starch grains, I think, are down around 10 microns in diameter.
Uh-huh.
So, Dr. Pete, do you think that eating a protein with your potato would increase the enzymatic digestion of the starch?
Well, if the potato is very well cooked, it has such high-quality protein that people subsist very well on a pure potato diet, basically. In New Guinea, some of the people on a traditional diet would eat basically just potatoes for 50 weeks out of the year. Then for 1 or 2 weeks, they would have regional feast for several days. They would eat pork just 1 or 2 weeks out of the year. But because of that very high potato diet for 50 weeks of the year, they were studied in detail and found to be well-muscled, generally very healthy, as if they had been eating a perfectly balanced diet all year. And that was what got people interested in the high quality of potato protein. So
it'd be interesting to know if people that are eating a food like that over a long period of time, if they've kind of developed different strategies, like, you know, really chewing it well and making sure that they're breaking the starch down somehow, or they've either adapted maybe to, I don't know, is that possible for a stomach to secrete specific types of enzymes that are breaking down starch molecules better because generation after generation they're eating that type of food, I wonder?
Just in a few months, a person's digestive system will adapt considerably. In animal experiments, if they feed a highly nutritious diet, the size and the length and weight of the intestine is very small. If they eat a very poor, high starch diet, high fiber, the intestine grows in length and mass. Almost like they're producing an organ specifically for the type of food they're eating.
And a good way to get the protein out of the, I know we have a caller, but good way to get the protein out of the potato is to juice it. Dr. Pete, you've taught me that. And you juice a raw potato, and then you let the starch granules fall to the bottom of the liquid, and then you strain, or you just pour off the clear liquid and don't use the starch at the bottom. It sinks. It's almost like a cornstarch you see sunk to the bottom of the cup. And then you can cook that very, very slowly in a double boiler with butter, or just very slowly. And it is like scrambled eggs. And so for a vegetarian, very high quality protein, that's a great thing to do.
I actually made a soup last week where I juiced potatoes and then put that just in a pan and got it boiling. And then I put in bamboo shoots and shiitake mushrooms, and man, was it good.
Okay, we better get this next caller.
Thanks for your call. And let's take this next caller. Hello, you're on the air. Where are you from?
North Carolina.
Yeah, what's your question?
Is there a way to process or cook beans, like maybe with an alkali, to transmute the negative effects of the starch?
Dr. Pete.
To cook what was the
first? To cook beans.
Legumes.
Legumes.
Well, you can find information on nixtamalizing even beans. I've never tried it, but
so that's processing boiling the beans with a lye or lime.
Yeah.
Oh, so it would work with the beans as well as with the corn.
That's what some people are saying on the internet, and would it
negate the phytates that are present in the beans?
I think it does liberate the minerals, at least, from the phytic acid.
And are they saying that they're not thyroid suppressive as a result of that?
Well, it still probably has the...
No, I don't know that.
Okay.
Well, soaking beans is a very traditional way to prepare them. Soaking for 3 days, you're activating a lot of enzymes that help break down the toxins.
That increases the protein value, too, greatly.
So anyone who eats beans should soak them for 3 days, rinsing the water.
Yeah, as they approach sprouting, storage protein turns to growth protein, which is less toxic and more nutritious.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so getting back to the starches in, just in case anybody else is listening and they want to call in, it's... 1-800-KMUD-RAD is his toll-free number, or the local area is 923-2513.
Wait, no, 923-3911.
3911, what am I saying? Okay, too excited.
Oh, you're reading the other number.
Dr. Pete, okay, so we're talking about starches and it's not being particularly healthy, unless in some of the instances that we covered, you can make them more digestible and more manageable for your gut to process them. But so people understand how big an industry the whole starch industry is, especially with the GMO patentable own the seed type of approach to mass producing starch, folks.
And that's what the majority of children eat and crave is starches. So no wonder they need the vaccines.
And if you looked at your packaging and your labeling, you would see all these different numbers would be on there, and there are things like acid-treated starch, alkaline-treated, bleached starch, oxidized starch, monostarch, distarch, phosphated starch, acetylated, hydroxypropylized. The list goes on and on. It's huge. And most of what we're talking about here is not healthy, and it's not, I know it would not pass any kind of scientific rigor for the true definition of good, healthy food. And that's just the beginning. That's the tip of the iceberg. There is actually a grain processing corporation, folks. Okay. It's called the Grain Processing Corporation, if you'd like to look it up online. They produce things like B700 pure corn starch, oxidized starch, stabilized starch, binding coating starch. And the list goes on there too. And it's all about putting this into the food stream, and it's in most of the foods that you will have previously never had these things in. Anyway, we have another caller on the air. So take this next call. Caller, where are you from?
Yes, good evening.
Hi, where are you from?
I have a question about potatoes. Does it matter which kind? Because I heard that the tribes that eat them eat yams, but I thought that was a South American tribe. Is there one? I like Yukon Golds particularly, and I know the russets are real popular, but are they as nutritious?
Dr. P, I don't know if it's preference.
Each variety of potato varies in the quantity of starch relative to protein, but the whole family has high-quality protein, and it's just the digestibility that is the main difference. The high carotene content can make them hard to digest for some people.
That's what we would call a waxy potato, one that doesn't start falling apart in the pan as easily, right, Dr. P?
And the yellow color is carotene.
And when the skins turn green, isn't that a toxin?
Yes.
Nightshade?
A solanine. Poisonous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If the FDA had that come into, it was just discovered right now, potatoes would be outlawed in case they turn green.
How bad is it for you? Because it tastes terrible.
A solanine, yeah, that's pretty toxic.
So you peel potatoes, but I like to eat the peels unless they're green.
Well, if your potato is non-organic, you need to stay away from the peel because they put so many chemicals on non-organic potatoes.
That is why, like that other gentleman, I plan on growing my own this year.
And of course, when you genetically modify potatoes, you can drench them in pesticides and herbicides. That's the whole point of...
Oh, yay.
Yeah. Anyway, it gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is another caller on the air.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
And let's see here. Caller, you're on the air, and where are you from? Hello, you're on the air. Where are you from?
From Honeydew.
Hi. What's your question?
I'd like to know, eating too much starch cause acid in your stomach, and what would prevent too much acid?
Dr. Pete. Acid production by...
The main function of acid in the stomach is digesting proteins, and it is responsive to the type of food you eat. And the starch doesn't necessarily stimulate acid production, but it might be irritating to the stomach in some other way, like the quality of the starch. If it's hard to digest, it's likely to be more irritating. And if it's so hard to digest that it passes along your intestine without breaking down significantly,
mm-hmm.
then it can support bacterial growth or fungal growth that can cause digestive problems.
And so high acid, high protein is hard, would make it less accessible for the acid? Should you eat more just high protein?
Usually the stomach can judge how much acid to secrete in proportion to the amount of protein that it senses.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Pete. I enjoy your show.
Thank you for your
call. Thank you for your call. Okay. So, Dr. Pete, can I ask you a little bit about xanthan and carrageenan gums? I know we have covered them in the past. I know you're opposed to them.
In the 1940s, the food industry was wanting to add various gums, locust bean,
carabine,
gum arabic, and the FDA looked at some of the evidence in animal studies and said they weren't appropriate to use in foods. But 40 or 50 years later, the industry had more power over the FDA, and now they're using not just the natural gums, which are more expensive, but they're finding ways to make synthetic gums with those chemical processes you mentioned, which are much cheaper than gum arabic or any of the beanie-derived gums.
I was trying to tell this to someone who said that they don't like to eat dairy when they have a cold because they think it increases their mucus production. And I told them that I'm sure it's the additives in the dairy that are irritating your intestine. And they said they buy good brands, but so many organic brands have these gums in them.
I think they're gradually getting away from carrageenan, which is a very powerful allergen and inflammation promoter.
And this is because of the literature against it, right?
The evidence is just tremendous. It degrades under the influence of bacteria in the intestine, and degraded carrageenan is generally widely recognized as a carcinogen.
Well, it's found in organic whipping cream.
I
won't mention the brand.
The industry to promote these manufactured cheap artificial gums to use in food processing, extending shelf life, reducing the need for nutrients in the food. The industry has promoted the idea that resistant starches are health foods, that by feeding bacteria, which break them down and produce some short molecules such as butyric acid and lactic acid, that this will supposedly prevent bowel cancer. But in fact, it's causing changes in your brain and general nervous system to absorb these broken down products of the resistant starches.
Well, what is the name of that scientist who's 100 years old and looks really great and young, and he eats eggs, fruits?
Fred Kummerow?
Yes, egg, fruits. His diet consists primarily of eggs, fruits, vegetables, meat,
and dairy.
Just a traditional diet.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
A traditional old-fashioned diet of just real, pure food.
Let me quickly mention the whole thing about low-fat, and not just yogurt, but low-fat in general. I think the whole thing about low-fat is, I'm sure it was probably a marketing ploy for companies to profit from yet again another erroneous piece of science to produce chemicals that actually make the low-fat sim not low-fat, so it's more palatable by the consumer who's being told that fat is bad for you, that they produce modified starches for low-fat and microparticulated whey proteins, modified tapioca starch, and several other compounds, which certainly very questionable as food compounds, because you probably never normally eat these in the same quantities. And that's all on the back of fat being bad for you, which we know saturated fat is not bad for you. So the whole point about the dairy is that dairy does contain saturated fat, but it's not a bad thing. It's the liquid oils. I don't know actually if there is another caller on there. I know I see the engineer talking to someone, but I know we're getting pretty close. So
our word of advice for our listeners is, Read your labels. Eat organic foods as much as possible.
And spend your money on good quality food. It's far the cheapest way to live.
And then, sorry.
Okay, Dr. Pete, what do you think of lecithin? Do you have any...
When it comes from eggs produced by well-fed chickens, it's okay. But now it all comes from soybeans.
Right.
Soybeans are highly unsaturated fat. And so it's simply a way of getting too much PUFA into your system if you eat very much lecithin. But if it's just a trace of it, like to emulsify a chocolate bar or something, that small amount is harmless.
Okay. All right. Well, I know it's about 5 minutes to eight now, and I want to make sure that people do get some details about you, that they can go check you out on the internet and a lot of your work and read more about you. So thanks so much for joining us again this evening.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so just to quickly wrap up some of the other ingredients in food that people are probably not even aware of, things like phosphates and aluminum phosphate in particular. Sodium aluminum sulfate used as stabilizers, and there's obviously the artificial colors, things like propyl gallate and butylated hydroxy toluene, propyl paraben for keeping tortillas, muffins, and those kind of products fluffy, and food dyes, not to mention the food dyes that get put in, and then things like potassium bromate used to strengthen bread and cracker dough and help it rise. I mean, crying out loud, what's wrong with just good old-fashioned food? It's almost too simple. And I think that's what actually happens with time and life in time, is that the simple things just suddenly seem to be unbelievable because they're too simple. And unfortunately, technology wants to cover our eyes with the wool of its science, which is not rooted in real science, but is rooted in pseudoscience supported by big industry. And it's very much what we've said before, in keeping with Dr. Pete recommending a very simple diet of good quality foods, that you are what you eat. So for those people that have listened to the show and have enjoyed it and or want to know more about Dr. Pete, his website is www.raypete.com. He's got plenty of articles there. They're all, you can download them, print them out, share them, etc. They're all fully referenced, and he's been doing this for at least 45 years now, so he's extremely intelligent and he knows what he's talking about, and he's done a lot of research on it. And you can find the references that he gives. You can find all these people on the internet who unfortunately are just shining their tiny little light in the darkness here, but fortunately they are visible if you look for them. So I'd encourage people to go to his website, read the articles, hear what he has to say. It's good old-fashioned wisdom that's free.
Well, he's a genius of the highest order.
He certainly is. Okay, and for those people that have called in, thanks so much for your calls, and we'll do this again next month on June, the third Friday of the month.